Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans. It's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, we are doing an interview about the Trollord Games Kickstarter. So I brought my friend Sparky on, who introduced me to the system to begin with. And I understand he is now one of your wage slaves. I mean, one of your workers. I mean, a friend of the show.
I'm something. I'm a gnome of with many hats.
People
call him Rob, but
a wage slave. I like that.
So, Sparky, is there any truth to the rumor that nickname came because you burnt something down?
Yes.
Was it involving your electrical work? Because I know you were rewiring a cabin for someone.
No. No, but it was my I did almost burn my house down once.
Wait a second. So Sparky has a meaning? Give us
yes. Yes. I'll have to tell that story someday. It is hilarious.
As well, a big fan of burning stuff down.
Pyromancy needs to be your new class for your gnome. And you could like make it burn your own beard and stuff off.
Oh my gosh.
Sparky has inspired me. I need to start growing a beard now, dear audience.
As a little side note there, I did actually burn all the clothes and body hair off of a gnome in one of my CNC games once.
So it was a successful adventure, is that?
Yeah. He dropped this fire flash thing. He rolled an extra one. I'm like, you drop it.
On himself? That's pretty cool.
Yep. It was great.
You also have the distinction of having killed James M. Ward in a game.
I did have that too.
That was
really
awesome. Yes.
Good on you, plus one.
He was a werewolf, and James was a gnome, I think.
Yes, he was a gnome, and I ripped his head off.
And Sparky ate him.
So, all gnomes must die.
Yeah. It doesn't matter who the gnome is, but yeah. All right, so that's Sparky.
That's why I peaked in life, guys. Just so you know.
At least it wasn't high school.
Downhill from here.
All right, and then we've got our guests. We're going to start with alphabetic order. So, Davis, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers at home?
Davis Chenault. I work for Trollord Games. I'm one of the co-designers of Castles and Crusades, the role-playing game.
Standing in last, but certainly not least, we have his equally as good-looking brother, Steve. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Steven Chenault. I'm CEO of Trollord Games. I do a lot of writing, designing around here, but Davis sold himself short. He's one of the original founders with me and Mac Golden of Trollord Games.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. I hopped my car to fund the game, fund the company.
You did. You came from somewhere out west and some dig you were doing.
I mean, you do what you got to do. So, and then how we first found them. So I actually discovered Trollord Games at about the same time from both James M. Ward, who sent me when we were working on the series together, the Gods and Demigods manual he wrote for your guys. Yep. And when I told people, they thought he was sending me, because he said it was an original, the original one he wrote for TSR, and they're like, dude, I'll buy that from you. And I told James that, and he goes, I don't like you that much, JR. Because that's got, I guess, some monetary value to it. And then Sparky introduced it. At the time, we were playing Swords and Wizardry because it was a simpler version. Yeah. He's like, you ought to try this CNC game. It's the same better. Thing, but cooler. So when time and money allow, I will definitely be buying the entire work so I can run a campaign in your game. So if my editors complain and my publishers complain that my books come in late, just know it's your fault, all right?
Actually, as a side fact right there, JR, you have played in one of my Castles and Crusades game. Of course, then
I didn't realize that's what the system was.
Yeah, okay. And then later, since you only played that one session, the PC, I kind of made an NPC, and the NPC got killed and was then reincarnated as a gnome of all things.
Did it die doing something gloriously stupid? Because that's the way to go.
It was like a crossbow bolt to the neck. It was
terrible. It happens. But if you're going to do it and you're going to die so irreverently, you got to give him like a 40-page backstory. I think that's what
Go all in.
First roll, you die.
The funny thing is some of those backstories, and I'm like, you know, it's kind of tragic, but I get it. Nobody goes adventuring for no reason. Yeah. And it's like, oh, I killed a dragon that killed my mom, but I died from rats in a basement.
I don't know. I think, you know, saying, hey, I had to go adventuring to pay off my gambling debts, you know, that's
ooh, I like that.
I burned my house down. I gotta go make some money.
Yeah, I know that.
What are your bookies?
Oh, those are actually great backstories, because you don't really need a complex backstory, I don't think. But you need a good one, like just and that one liner. I have to pay off my gambling debts. That's a good one. I burned down my house and I need some money.
I gotta remember that for NPC.
It does sort of imply the morality of your character. It's kind of hard to play a paladin, but that is your backstory.
Yeah, right, right.
although, I guess there are different gods out there, so maybe with the right god, that paladin backstory still works.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Davis, before we dive into the awesome worlds that are Trollord Games, you do have to pass the first test, and it is the religion questions. Are you ready, sir?
I am ready.
All right. Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
Firefly.
Outstanding answer. Space Westerns. They'll never take the sky from us.
Yes. No.
All right.
Firefly beats them all.
I love it. And it didn't have time to last long enough to be ruined by ineptitude TV.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100% because, you know, it maybe could have used another season or two, you know, for fun. But the fact that it just sort of like died. It died on a high note, okay? So you can never take that away. You can never say it just fell into obscurity or backfired.
You know, it's kind of like all those, you know, the big rock singers from the 60s who died of drug overdoses at like 9. They died at the top of their game. They didn't, you know, get old and die in obscurity.
Although, you know, this is why they say sobriety ruined rock and roll. But yeah, so the only bad thing is if they had lasted longer in the 80s and 90s, Hollywood had this thing where they had to do at one episode, everybody went to Disney because it was filler, and you had to have an episode where it became a musical for some reason. Just randomly people would bust in the song. And can you imagine Nathan Fillion trying to sing?
Didn't Star Wars have a musical too?
The Christmas special, I know, had some musical bits.
Yes,
that's right. I interviewed the guy that played Darth. I think it was Darth. No, it was either he played Darth Vader or Boba Fett. Rainbow Sun Franks, who's a actor who's gotten some bigger shows recently. His dad was in the Star Wars musical.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his dad was an actor too. That makes me wonder if it broke the dad's brain, and that's why he named his son Rainbow. that starts to make sense to me.
I always wondered about that when I watched him on Stargate Atlantis. I'm like, what?
That's where I found him, and I interviewed him. He's a fun dude.
What did they do that to him?
What did they do to him?
In country music, we learned about the boy named Sue, and maybe it was just trying to make him tough.
There you go.
So, all right, since we are polytheistic here at the Blasters and Blades podcast, the Game of Thrones, Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
Ooh, that one's a hard one. Dude, that's a hard question because I just watched The Wheel of Time on Netflix, right? And I actually really, I know that show's been like hit, like a lot of people don't like it. I super enjoyed it. I enjoyed almost all of it. So I think currently as it stands, I'm going to go with The Wheel of Time, the Netflix thing.
Okay, so I don't always agree when people pan it. Like, everyone panned the live-action Avatar that Netflix is doing in conjunction with Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
I am not a fanatic to the lore. I accept that they change some things when they do reimaginings. Mm-hmm. But I'm enjoying it. I think the first 8 episodes are done. And everyone hated it. I think sometimes hating things is just popular right now.
Yeah.
I can accept that Amazon changed things with the Wheel of Time. But if you accept it as its own property, it wasn't bad. They needed better costuming for what they paid, but
yeah, they could have used some better costuming. But the overall, I completely divorced myself because it's been when was The Wheel of Time published? 1400s? I don't know. It seems like close. It was ages ago, and so I didn't bring any baggage from the books over. So I could watch it completely in and of itself as a show. And I was like, oh, I really, really enjoyed this. Now, but saying, you know, the Game of Thrones, that was a hard, like, I started it like 5 times the first episode before I actually finally watched the first episode. And the end of the first episode had me hooked. I mean, I was like a fish on a line and being reeled right in until about, I think it was season 3 or 4, I was just like, maybe 5, I was just like, So, but the Wheel of Time just kept me in, and I think they're doing another season, aren't they?
Maybe. Answer the question, Davis. Narnia, Wheel of Time, or Game of Thrones?
I want to play all day. I'll go with Wheel of Time.
I enjoyed the Wheel of Time. I canceled my Amazon Prime, so I only watched the first season, but I thought it was pretty good. I think the original Lord of the Rings movies, they kind of ruined us to what fantasy can look like on the big screen. And so they kind of set the bar so high that we just don't accept the campy costumes anymore.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. And the first Wheel of Time came out in like 96 or 97, I believe. I know it was late 90s.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I can't honestly remember. It just seems like ages ago to me. Anyway, that was
like 20 years ago or something like that. So
it's a couple of lifetimes ago.
This in the 90s. That wasn't that long ago, guys. God.
Right. It's only 20 years ago. So, and because we are civilized human beings, we are no longer knuckle dragging troglodytes. Coffee or tea, and how do you take it?
Coffee, black.
I make myself drink the coffee black because I can't afford the calories of the creamer, but if I had a preference, I'm putting French vanilla in it every day.
Yeah, I started on cappuccinos, and now I'm just like straight coffee black.
Well, I enjoy a good cappuccino too, although you got to add a little bit of flavor to it. Like I'm a huge French vanilla. I'll do a lot. I won't do anything for a Klondike bar, but for French vanilla, I might murder some people. So, all right. Now that we got the introduction out of the way, I understand you guys are tight on time. So we'll just dive right in. So let's start with Trollord Games. So how did the creation of your system come about?
You mean Castles and Crusades or the company?
Isn't that what I said?
Yeah. Well, you said Trollord Games, so I didn't know.
Well, isn't Castles and Crusades your first game? Wasn't that what started the company?
No. We actually started a game called Swords and Sorcery that appeared in the back of the first four adventures that we did, three adventures in a world setting. And that was really kind of a setup that Davis and Matt Golden designed that was kind of very similar to D20 because Matt knew what was coming with third edition. So we did that for about, well, we did that for just the first round of publication. And then the second round of publication, it was Dungeons and Dragons material. Under the OGL using the SRD for D20 material. And we did that for 3 years or so, 4 years or so. And then Castles and Crusades came out in 2004 when we were warned somewhere around in 03 that there was a bubble. There was a bubble in the D&D market coming and we better do something. John Nephew told me about that. So we began designing Castles and Crusades and it released in 2004. Roughly, we'd been in your business for about 5 years at that point. But then CNC becomes the primary vehicle that we're publishing that. And at the time, Gary Gygax, and we published Gary Gygax up until 2008 when he crossed over. And then from 2008 up until recently, so it's Castles and Crusades all.
So for those that you don't know, the OGL license that he's talking about is basically the older versions than whatever Wizards of the Coast was putting out. They let you make content for them. Is that correct? Because we want to make sure everyone understands.
Yeah.
All right. And so now you guys do exclusively the Castles and Crusades, not Crusaders. Don't get it wrong like I did, people. Okay. So what made you create Castles and Crusades the way you did? Because your Siege Engine, I don't think I've seen anything like that anywhere else.
I think it's pretty unique. Davis and Mac, and of course, he can go speak far more into the actual creation process. But we had in 03, there were a few pressures coming on to Trollord Games, to the company itself. One was the bubble in the market that I had mentioned earlier. Davis and Mac had been wanting to do a role-playing game and break away from Dungeons & Dragons anyway. So there was that pressure, the bubble pressure. And then Gary Gygax approached us and said, you know, I got this Castle Zagic material. I need a system that's very much like AD&D. And when I pitched him that he could make his own real quick and put it in the back of his Castle Zagic material, he didn't want to do any part of that. He wanted us to do something. So it kind of just worked out between what Davis and Mac were wanting to do and what Gary wanted us to do and really what the company needed at the time. So they began, Davis in 2003 started working on it, I think, something like that.
Yeah, Mac and I would meet on the front porch of my house. He lived just two houses down from me at the time. And we'd be down the front porch of my house at 9 o'clock at night, between 8 and 9 o'clock at night, and then stay up to like 2 or 3 in the morning, just sitting there designing games and stuff like that, or designing this game, working on this game. That was, 2003, because we knew it.
Yeah, 03, 04, and then you would send me rules and blah, 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 blah. And we had a lot of folks playtesting it on our boards at the time.
Yeah, and there was a ton of playtesting going on. And I think the breakthrough was when I actually broke down the maths of the game and I figured out the secret code in the game, which I won't go into. But it's in Castles and Crusades now, which is why the game is convertible, or you can convert to very easily from any rendition of the game.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And you can come to Castles and Crusades because there is a central mathematical formula that underpins literally the entirety of the game.
So when did you guys go from being a gaming company, being Troll Lord Games, and also being a book publishing company? Because I understand that you guys take the book production to the next level, unlike most companies do these days.
Yeah, that was actually Davis's idea. In 2004, I remember I flew out to a convention, 2004, I flew out to a convention in San Francisco, and we had to have three books, POD, print on demand, sent to us very quickly. And I can't remember what the shipping was. It was absolutely insane. It was like, you know, two-night express or some whatever it was. And it was like $240. And of course, in those days, we were a much smaller company. And I was furious. And I began just for the next several weeks hooting and hollering about it nonstop, about the cost of the books was high, the cost of the shipping was high. And then Davis was like, well, why don't we just make our own print shop? And I was like, because we can't. We don't know how to do it. And he's like, well, I don't know how to do it. And so we argued about it for about a month. And then we started investigating and hooked up with Xerox, bought an old cutter from some fella in South Little Rock, rented some machines from Xerox, and began printing and binding and cutting our own material. By 2005, we were up and running. 2006, we were up and running. By 2008, it was a full bore making our own books.
Now, except for the hardbacks, those are produced out.
We did the hardback thing for about 2 years. It just didn't take.
Yeah, it didn't take. But Kent, my brother, is a bibliophile, right? That guy collects books. He loves books, and he knows all about, like, not only what's in the book, but the construction of the book, right? Yeah. And I've never paid attention to the construction of a book. I don't care. It's in my hands. It'll get destroyed shortly. And that's basically how it works, right? So, but Kent, he works, he knows all the
time. Kent, for those of you who don't know, go ahead, Davis.
Okay, yeah. So he takes our printing. He will not accept, like, some of the binding and stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
So the quality, the actual physical quality of our books is super, super high. The hardback ones, for sure, super high.
I'll smite stone, and we'll send books back in a heartbeat. And that,
yeah.
And that Sparky remembers, we had a whole line of Monsters and Treasures that came, that were falling apart, and they had to redo the whole line. Of course, we were.
Yep. Is there any truth to the rumor that you pay Sparky and Dr. Pepper when he works for you?
No, Dr. Pepper is expensive these days.
Oh yeah, no way. Yeah.
So you get like the Circle K brand of fake Dr. Pepper?
No. Those were fighting words.
Yeah.
All right, so. Let's dive in, since that we brought you on to talk specifically about, you know, both understanding what is Troll Lord Games, but also your work with Gary Gygax, who some of you guys might have heard about. He created a game that kind of became Dungeons & Dragons. So how did your work with him? Did he just approach you out of the blue? Were you already working with him? Like, how did that evolve?
No, interestingly enough. So the company comes together in 1999. And Davis and Matt Golden and I sat down at Vino's Pizza Place and began talking about this company and putting stuff together. Matt was actually deeply involved in the legal discussions with the group that was putting the open gaming license together, which was being posed by Wizards of the Coast at the time to make everything open to get more people into the hobby. So when we did our first round of books, which was three adventures in one setting book, we launched at Gen Con in the year 2000. And unbeknownst to Davis and I, we were just, you know, whatever, going to Gen Con, trying to figure out what's going on. Mac took all of our books to Gary Gygax's booth over at Heckerforge and gave them to him and said, hey, thank you very much. Appreciate Dungeons & Dragons. It's all, you know, all the things that you do when you meet, you know, one of your idols. And then about 2 months after that Gen Con, Mac and I were talking about something. And he said, hey, man, why don't you shoot Gary Gygax an email and see if he enjoyed the books. And I didn't know what he was talking about, so he had to explain everything to me. So I found Gary's email somehow, or probably Mac found it, to be honest with you. And I shot Gary a quick email, you know, just say, hey, hope you got to appreciate the books, or whatever I said. I can't remember what I said. He wrote back almost immediately. And then Mac was on the other end, kept telling me, hey, you need to, why don't you see if we can't get him to write some adventures for us for D20? So I asked him, and he said, nope, not interested in that, but I do have these books that I would like to see published. Let's get on the phone. And probably within 2 or 3 days of that first email going to Gary, he and I were on the phone talking about the Gygaxian fantasy worlds and all kinds of projects that he wanted to do.
Okay, so rewarding being industrious and stepping out, I guess.
Yeah, so. I didn't think there was any chance in hell that any of this could come about. But Mac was like, yeah, Davis is, yeah, you need Davis too. But Mac's like, no, just give it a shot. You never know. And
he was it, you miss 100% of the shots you never take.
That's true.
So, and now, of course, when you guys are taking off, you're going to get a lot of people approaching you and dropping stuff off. And now you got to respond in kind, at least give it a shot.
Yeah. Harder, you know? Yeah, I'm pretty good actually about responding to any emails and stuff like that. And I think, Kent, you're pretty good about not as much anymore.
I'm pretty good at not responding to emails.
Well, anymore, yeah, anymore, Kent's pretty like just doesn't.
But I will sit here at least once a day when I meet an email going, just channel Gary Gygax. Because Gary never missed an email. He responded as quickly as he could.
Yeah.
I'm horrible with it.
Were the emails him or was it like a personal assistant kind of thing?
Oh, no, it was him. I was looking at some of the emails that he and I exchanged when we were actually doing the contractual negotiations for the final thing. And we ended up talking about, I happened to be reading a book on the history of the Habsburg dynasty at the time, and he was reading a book on the Magyars settlement in the Hungarian plateau, whatever that's called. And we got to talking about that. So they were very personal from a very, you know, from the get-go. So no, he didn't have an assistant. He was pretty insistent on, probably the only time I saw him get angry with us was when he thought we were getting between him and some of the people who loved his work. He was very, very gracious and thankful for everybody that was playing. And when people would come up, talk to him or email him or call him, I know for a fact that several people were passing through Lake Geneva, got a hold of Gary and he let him sleep at his house. I mean, he was just a super, he was super, super gracious about everybody that was playing the game.
That's always encouraging. You don't see that as much anymore. Sometimes you see people that have levels of success that almost like they start believing their own press.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's nice to hear. So I'm going to throw up the image from the Kickstarter, which is what you guys are talking about. And we're not going to, dear listener, we're not doing an actual commercial because they're sponsoring this episode with their Kickstarter. So link for that will be in the show notes. And we're just going to spend the next whatever the time is talking about it. But so you did this world with Gary, and then I understand, you know, briefly that there was some legal disputes on his estate end. And once that settled, you guys came back into getting ready to produce it. My understanding is you're working with his son, Luke, for this.
Yeah. So when Gary passed away in March of 2008, his wife pulled the licenses later that year. She had her own kind of plan that she wanted to pursue. So we went our direction, mostly with Castle Estates and the estate. Miss Gygax continued to do all of the work for many, many, many years. There were some legal issues. I'm not going to go into any of that, but there's legal issues. And it opened up and Luke contacted us and the court contacted us via Luke and said, hey, you know, do you have a plan or would you like to, you know, get involved in this? So we put a plan together, sent it to the court. They approved. And here we are again in 2024, picking up exactly where we left off in 2008.
Okay. And so now that you guys are picking it off, what is the plan going forward? There is a Kickstarter. It looks like the worlds are already built. So the Kickstarter is just a way of sort of funding it and getting the words out. I think Kickstarter has almost become a pre-sale venue as much as funding things. And there are costs in getting a print run, I imagine. That doesn't happen cheaply with the cost of wood and paper these days.
Oh, my God.
So what is the Kickstarter offering? And then, like, what kind of stretch goals were you guys thinking about?
So these books, Davis, you want me to dive into this?
Yeah, yeah. You know it far more intimately and could do it more logically than I can.
Okay.
I'm just going to go start talking about each of the books.
So the book, the series of books is the Gary call it, we call it the Gygaxian Fantasy World Series. And it's essentially an encyclopedia of how-tos for world building, game design, module adventure design, running games, creating characters, all kinds, everything that goes along with the RPG hobby. Gary envisioned to go into this series of books. Now, when he was still alive, we published 7 of them. We had another 3 in the works, and there was another 3 or 5, I'd have to get my list open, that were planned, that were partially written or started to be writing, because he really envisioned this series of books to be open-ended. And it's really world-building books. It's how to create a city environment. That's the Canting Crew. How to flesh out your entire world. That's the World Builder. The Living Fantasy is how to create a fantasy environment to play your games in. Book of Names is 100,000 names plus name generators and name creators. NCDA, the adventure building is how to build an adventure. And then you got Nation Builder and Cosmos Builder, which are how to build cosmos and nations. So they're really all how to world build books. And I remember watching about 2 years ago when at the height of fifth edition, so many TikToks and YouTubes and YouTube shows and all kinds of stuff, people talking about world building. You could see all these gamers had a huge number of gamers had joined the hobby. A lot of them were younger, and they were just learning how to world build and get into this stuff and loving it and discovering the joy of world building, whether you're playing or GMing or whatever it is you're doing. And these books, though they were out of print at the time, we'll get them back into print soon, are the perfect toolbox really for all of those people who want to do that. It's just filled with a plethora of information. And Gary had it open-ended, like I said. He really didn't envision an end of it until every subject matter of world building and adventure design and character design was covered. So what we'll do, and this Kickstarter is we'll offer the 7 that we've already written and were published. We're going to republish those. They've been out of print since 2008. You can only get them on eBay for like $300 to $500, depending on which one you were trying to get. Yeah. We'll bring these 7 out, and we'll use the stretch goals will be built around kind of improving them and also the other 3 books that were finished but never actually saw print.
So this sounds like it could be useful both for gamers but also for anyone that's being a creative. So if you're writing comics or movie
that's
scripts.
That's what I was about to say. You stole my question, JR. Yeah, clearly these books transcend just world building for the game table. These would be very handy because I've seen the contents of some of them, and the level of detail they offer would be very beneficial to writers too.
Yes,
anybody who's trying to figure out the ins and outs of building an authentic world.
Yeah.
Yes. No, yeah, I think that's right. Whenever you put pen to paper and you're trying to create something that's like livable, like that would actually exist, Gary touches on a multitude of topics that one needs to address to build that world in such a way that others believe it to be a real world. All those, and there's, it's funny you mentioned you had an open-ended thing. That could have been hundreds of volumes.
Yeah.
Are you saying Gary had no shortage of ideas and creativity?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. That's one of the things I learned from James Ward working with him is because you could throw a one-liner about something you don't think is important and you move on. And James is like, okay, but that actually means something if that is the currency. Okay, so what does that mean about this and this? Yeah. And all the knock-on effects of things that you don't think about because they happen under the surface. And you don't necessarily have to talk about them if you're writing a novel, but you better understand it because you could break your story by writing something else later on that contradicts it.
Right.
Yes. No, that's very, very true. Those small details and that knock-on effect, what is it, like the butterfly effect of those small mm-hmm. details, if you don't pay attention to them, they can wreck your setting or break that suspension of disbelief, basically, is what it will do. Not wreck your setting, but...
I didn't grow up around a horse farm, but I know, like, I've got a cousin that was a horse fanatic. So one of the things you see that a lot in fantasy, where the horses never seem to stop, and even the poorest of the poor can afford a horse. And I'm like, so it's clearly someone doesn't understand how the equine industry works.
Right? They don't understand horse people and what the trials and tribulations they suffer.
You don't think about, like, until you own, like, when I had pets as a kid, my parents had dogs. I never considered what went into that until I had a dog, and I'm paying the vet bills, and I'm buying the food and trying to make sure they're healthy. And you know, that's part of that knock-on effect. So if someone's got a horse, and they'll use that as a perfect example in fantasy, like, okay, where are they getting the feed for it if they can barely feed themselves? Yeah. And you see that a lot in fantasy. So this sounds like these kinds of books would prevent people from making those mistakes.
Yes, that's what they're designed to do. And like David said, it gives you a kind of a realistic view of what a fantasy world would be like.
Yeah, and just, you know, just as an example, using a horse, and it's Sparky, were you raised around horses?
Kind of, sort of.
Okay. I took care of them
as a kid.
Okay. I sort of gathered that from your comment. So a horse is, and we had three up here for a while, they can be a lot to take care of. But just imagine traveling with a horse in your fantasy setting. So when you stop at an inn at night, you have to have, that horse has to go somewhere, right? So you have these stables. And then you have to say, well, who's stabling it? And what you end up doing is you're creating this whole world around just the horse alone. Because if everyone's using horses, or a lot of people are using horses, there's going to be stables. And what was one of the big things, like when the car was first introduced and the street cleaners in New York City were complaining that they were going to lose their job because they didn't have any poop. There's less and less poop to clean up, right? Until eventually there's no poop cleaners, you know, no poop scoopers. So, yeah, there's tons of knock-on effects that you should be aware of on those things. That's cool. I didn't thought about the horse that detail before.
Yeah, well, Sparky was born in Texas, so he was born with a six-shooter on his hip, a cowboy hat, probably some dip or a cigar, and on a horse. He was born that way. It's just how it works in Texas.
And my better half is all about the horses, and she wants to get horses eventually at some point, so God help us all.
Dude, that would be awesome. Do it.
So what other, so you mentioned some of the world building books. Are there going to be follow-on world building books that he's already written, or would you guys be adding into his creation at that point? Like, where's the line? So you run out of his books.
So currently we have to act under the umbrella of the court order, what we're allowed to do. Now we're given all of the content for the Gygaxian Fantasy World series and some other material like Castle Zaggy under this particular court order. But my intent, our intent, is to do the seven that we previously did, the three that we knew were in the hopper. We'll take a look at the others that he had wanted to do, find out how far we were, in production of these things, or he was in production of these things. I got an email yesterday that from one of the authors from the Seafaring book that he was about halfway through it. He had 110 pages of written content. So that's quite a bit of material. So that those we'll probably pursue. I'm not certain that it would be the right thing to do to keep doing works with Gary's name on them that he didn't approve. Does that make sense?
Some could see that like as a cash grab situation.
Yeah, I mean,
This is contributing to Gary's legacy,
exactly. So yeah. if Davis and I were to oversee, say, a book on the undead that goes in this GFW series, Gary wouldn't have read this. Gary wouldn't have approved this. So we can't logically and honorably put our his name on it because he didn't see it. But now there's other material, like the three books I know he saw, two are written by him, so that, you know, pretty much there is. And the other one I know that he saw because he sent it to me completed. It needed editing, but it was done. So
does that include Essential Places?
No, that is, well, yeah, now, yes, that is Essential Places, the Wayland Smith catalog, and the Pantheon book. Yes, that is Essential Places.
Okay. So are you actually going to do the seafaring one? Because I find that interesting. You have to have enough NPCs that the sailor can afford a female in every port. Because I'm told that's a requirement to do. So there's got to be enough women. You can't have an all-male pallet.
Into a gray zone for sure.
Yeah, that's one of those things, though. You see it a lot in sci-fi where they'll land on the planets and you notice it more there. and you look at the population and it's not enough to support genetic diversity, that's going to apply in fantasy worlds too. If you have only so many people, eventually you're going to have problems. So you have to plan for the population too.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
And I'm pretty sure Gary accounts for this in these books, because you know I've seen some of the contents and the absolute level of detail that and I can't remember which book, there was like one in one of the books, he had a whole section on how much like a, you know, an acre of land, how much food he can produce with this variable and that variable. And it was just like, holy shit, this is actually valuable to me in real life. It's like, these books are providing it, like I've learned something here.
That's living fantasy. And there's a, I think in World Builder, there's a couple of pages on weights and measurements. It's a great tool for if you're in any kind of, you know, planning it for the real world.
Yeah. That's funny, Sparky, that you would say that, because when I first started getting my kids into tabletop role-playing games, they're like, you tricked me. This is math and learning.
I think it's like on the last week's stream, isn't there a chart on there about the tensile strength of rope?
Yes.
It's like, you know, it's like that level. It's like, a lot of people are like, well, that's not going to be useful. Actually, you know, you might be surprised.
You might be surprised.
Actually, I do have one question. This is directed at Steve. Did Gary write anything about river crossings in
Yes, he did, actually. There's a whole section on river transport. So,
so do you have anything? Because you see a lot of fantasy and a lot of RPGs. They factor in religion, the gods of the various pantheons. Is that something he wrote about how to create that you potentially be publishing?
Yeah, it's addressed in two areas. In one of the books that wasn't actually printed, Pantheons, he wrote, and that's how to build a pantheon and how to, you know, a typical example and all that stuff. But in Living Fantasy, actually, there's a whole section on how, you know, a magic-wielding priesthood would change the way healthcare is done in the world. It's he touches on that as well.
You know, I hadn't even thought about the magic in the healthcare, but that's part of those knock-on effects you talk about.
Yeah, that's if paladins and clerics and druids can cure disease, it changes the game.
Or even that, illusionist, yeah. No, you could set up.
And that locks off, you know, most of the early development of alcohol, for instance, was because the water wasn't safe to drink necessarily before they knew to boil it. So if you have healthy water because you have magic, do they have the impetus to invent booze in your world? That kind of stuff. Drunk. They didn't know it would do that until they invented it. They were just trying to be...
I will point out on the booze things, baboons enjoy getting drunk, and what they do is gather around like citrus trees, like I can't remember, it's an orange tree or something like that, right? When the fruit is about to drop, they gather around it and they won't let anything near those trees. They will chase everything off until the fruit falls. And once the fruit has fermented just a little bit, enough to get them drunk, they will go up and devour that fruit.
What you're saying is the baboons are enlisted in the U.S. Army. I got it.
So that there, ladies and gentlemen, was the educational segment of this podcast.
I think we just became best friends. I like you.
In our blood. Drinking's in our blood. So,
do you cover, speaking of baboons, do you cover like what animals potentially would inhabit? Is the assumption just you're using earth animals, or does it cover how to create fantasy animals that, you know?
And the World Builder touches, it's got lists of animals that you can put in the campaign setting. And I think they're broken around by terrain, not necessarily biome. He's got a great section on trees that breaks the trees out by biome and temperature and all of that business. But one of the books that he wanted was a monster book, and he didn't get into a whole ecology of monsters in the series that we have now. It's touched on in the various books, Living Fantasy and World Builder, but not in the detail that I know that he would have done it when he, you know, dove into that subject.
This is more of a statement, and I'm kind of curious if you agree with it. Would you say books like these are probably more important now than they ever have been? Because right now, with the internet being in kind of a weird place, like, when's the last time you actually found what you're looking for on Google? Easily.
Never.
You know, like, say, I broke Davis. You know what I mean?
Finding
information is harder now than it's been in a long time. And having all these books with this wealth of information in a concentrated form, I think it's almost as worth its weight in gold.
Oh, yeah. No, I would agree, Sparky. so when the internet, so I remember when the internet first arrived.
In the good old days.
Yeah, back in the good old days. And there was a while it seemed like finding good information on the internet, it was never easy, but you could find it, you know, peer-reviewed papers.
Yeah.
Because the only people who went to the internet were really tended to be really well informed, but only ones who would sit there and write these long articles and stuff like that on subject matter. But since that time, I think roughly 2009, 2011, somewhere around in there, it started to switch up such that now I hardly even bother going to Google anymore. Hence, I started building my bookshelves and getting my books all back out.
Yep.
And, you know, using Living Fantasy and wishing that I were close to a university library again, because it's easier to access good information at libraries or in books now than it is on the internet.
So I'll answer that with a perfect metaphor. So earlier I was listening, I got a record player behind me where I was listening to a Cult of Source Erectus by Blue Oyster Cult. The record player, it goofed up and it wouldn't work. So I turned it off, figured it was overheating, but I wanted to hear the album. So I went to YouTube, opened a full album, you know, Blue Oyster Cult, blah, blah, blah. And it was playing Monsters, which is probably in the top three of my favorite VOC songs. And in the middle of it, and Monsters is a fast-paced song. It's a very fast-paced. It's great. It's great to, you know, write to and stuff. In the middle of it, it stopped, and some weird dingy music came in, and they were selling some kind of soap or something. I don't know. It took my brain like 10 or 15 seconds to realize, wait, what happened? How did my train wreck? What's going on? It switched to a second advertisement. So I cut it off, and I worked in silence for an hour or so until my record player could cool down a little bit. And that's what the internet's become like. You go to look up something and this, like, I want to do a name. I'm going to do a name generator. First, I'm going to have five sites that are all blanketed in advertisements. They're mostly probably spyware and whatever launched on your computer. Well, it's just a pain. I don't do it. I've just quit.
As a little side note there, just last night, a matter of fact, I was looking at, and I know it's Wikipedia, but there's that one time Wikipedia, you know, if you took it with a grain of salt, you could like get the highlights, fine. But I got the looking at this entry, and I'm not going to go into it because it kind of veers into it. It's been a 20-year running edit war over political spheres, I thought, and it's complete insanity.
Yeah,
and they cut out all the information that's actually valuable to just, you know, try to argue over just stuff that doesn't matter. And that's the internet in a nutshell.
And that's to play into your question. I remember a few months ago, my son was doing a paper on Lenin, and he saw something on the internet that Lenin died of lead poisoning. And he kept all this weird gobbledygook information. So I've got a pretty extensive library out there, mostly history books. So we pulled out three books that bios that I had on Lenin, and we went through them all, and we found out that it was a German doctor that said he died of lead poisoning caused by the type of bullet that he was shot with back in 1990. and then I asked my wife, I said, is this actually possible? And she's in the medical field. She goes, yeah, it's absolutely possible. So the lead that eked into his blood had something to do with it. But what Wilson had in front of him were three books that cited material sourced by historians who are pretty dry, you know, pretty boring sometimes because they're just reciting what happened, but it's actual valid information. And I think that when you get the Gygaxian Fantasy World Series in your hand, when you get these seven books, you're not going to have to deal with any of this stuff. You're going to open this book. The Book of Names is 100,000 names in there. That section has, it's the first section is the importance of a name, how to create, how to choose a name. The second section is names from ancient Phoenicia, modern Germany, ancient Germany, modern France, Polynesia, China, Japan, Arabia. I mean, it's 100,000 names. And then the last section is how to create fantasy names. So it's this just a wealth of information that you can open up in front of you. You can read in the bathtub. You can do whatever you need to do. And we're not going to put any advertisements in it. Nothing's going to pop out at you. It'll be great.
And one thing I want to mention on that to Ken's point, though, that a lot of the material in there is very, very, very well researched. So the Book of Names, for example, the 100,000 names, these are all actual names of human beings, yes, you know, stretching back into antiquity, you know, broken down, you know, Egyptian, Greek, ancient Greek, Roman, you know, Italian, whatever, you know, you pick it and it's out there. As with like the canting crew, it has an actual cant in it, a thieves cant, yep, that is well researched and based on actual historical cants from the 19th.
From the 1600s, 1700s, yeah.
1600s, 1700s, and 1800s. So it's all, a lot of it's really, really, really well researched. Now, some of it, of course, Gary had to create, you know, for fantasy, but fantasy, right, thing, you know, fantasy world building, and there's no historical reference documents for that, so, necessarily. But
for those that don't know, a cant is a language that is created mostly through like jargon of a specific field. So, like, if you have a specific sign language the thieves use so they can communicate with each other, like David Eddings did in his Belgarion, that would be technically a cant. C-A-N-T. Yes. So.
It's funny you mentioned that because a lot of people speak a cant today. And you'll find gangs speak cant.
True.
You know, anyway,
modern kids on the internet. I mean, I don't know.
I think lawyers speak a cant too. They have their own little language that they speak.
And then they charge you big bucks to translate to you.
That's called Latin, people. It's just a dead language. But yeah, that's the funny thing is, yes, it's in, like, I've dealt with this when writing characters that were like Australian. Like, technically, we're the same language, but we're not the same language. Right. And that you're going to get that effect when you deal with people with different cultures and life experiences, and that's something you would have to factor into a game.
Right. Yes.
So you mentioned there's a book. It was on one of the pictures that she sent with all the books that are in this bundle. That it's Insania. It started with an I. Which book is that? That's the one that's not clear to me what its contents are.
That's the one that I can't now. It's been so long ago. Insidia means direction or something, but that's the adventure building, how to write and or build an adventure, to write one for publication or to build one for your game. It's the shortest of the books, written by Dan Cross. It's a great book, but it's basically how to create an adventure or adventure arc.
Does it cover how to balance things? Because apparently, I when I was dungeon mastering, I was sending them against things that was way out of their level and like, almost killing whole parties. And oops,
that's fine.
Yeah, it's just like, oops. Well, you know better for next time. It's fine. Yeah. I've always had a problem with balance. I'm like, it's fine.
Just remember, your world is unbalanced. That's the cornerstone of your world. It's not balanced.
If real life was balanced, things would be a lot easier. This is the way it is in the real world. Fuck it up.
Is there at any point a book on, like, you know, Gary's advice to dungeon masters? Because, like, I figure I'm not alone that I stumbled into dungeon mastering because I couldn't find enough games, because there seems to be, that's the bottleneck for most gamers, right? It's finding someone to actually lead the game. So I said, screw it. How bad could it be, right? I'll try it. It's all Sparky's fault. So is there any plan at some point with future, and did Gary plan any of that on, like, advice to actual DMs in general, like, more broadly speaking?
He actually wrote a book, I can't remember the name of it now, back in the 80s, that would be that very thing. And though we don't have one in this, I've actually written a book called GM's Tricks of the Trade. It's actually, Davis, I keep forgetting, I got to talk to you and Chuck about it, but it's ready for print. I mean, it's just ready to go to the printers. And it's that very thing. I've been running games since, and Davis started running me in games in 75, 6, and I started running in 1980. So I kind of took all of my tricks and tips and all that stuff and put them into one large Dumaflocky. But we don't have that from Gary, but we do have something like that coming out for me.
I'll have to find that when it comes live because I'll be buying it. But so one of the things some gaming companies will do, and some authors do it too, if you buy the print copy, they kind of by default will give you the PDF or EPUB or whatever format for the ebook. Because I know a lot of people like to read through the ebook, but they want a physical copy to keep on hand for, you know, collections, whatever. Is that something Troll Lord Games does, that if you buy the print, you can get the ebook with it, or is it always separate purchases? How's that going to work for these books?
So two answers to that question. If you back the Kickstarter, The PDFs will be built into the level that that book is in. So that you'll get the PDF there. On our store, however, we sell things. You can buy the book. You can buy the book and the PDF or the PDF. And if you get the book and the PDF, you get a tremendously discounted PDF with the book. It's usually just a $8, $10 more or $5, or what, depending on the size of the book and whatnot.
Okay. So your company, as a general policy, gives you a discount if you're getting both at the same time. But it's built into the tiers of, you know, what you sub back with this. So what is your goal going to be to make sure this is funded? Like, what's the level you have to hit?
We're probably going to set it at about 25,000. I'm thinking it's 7 hardcover books, each of them about 200 pages long. We haven't decided whether they're going to go full color yet or not. And we may build that into the Kickstarter or not, because they don't really need to be full color. And when you go full color, you got to go with a heavier gloss paper, usually 70-pound gloss, and which makes the books heavier. But it also doesn't. That page isn't going to hold the printed word. I mean, it holds it well, but not as well as a 60-pound text that will hold blah blah blah. But so this is what Davis was talking about earlier. I'm really getting into the manufacturing side of it, but. So we'll determine whether they're going to be full color. We're kind of leaning in that direction, but we'll see. But they'll definitely be large, 200-page hardcover, 8.5 by 11.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, black and white on the right paper holds longer than color on any paper, ever.
A little smear.
I've learned so much about printing in paper since meeting you guys. It's crazy.
Yes, but will you employ monks to decorate the pages with the little pictures on the side?
Hey, Chuck! I'm going to talk for
you. You know, my daughter just finished a year stint overseas studying medieval manuscripts, and she would send me those little pictures that the monks drew. Those things were hysterical.
Oh, yeah.
I was one of my two interns as a grad student at Nova was working in the special collections archive and scanning. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. I was scanning all of those. And so one of the collections they had was like one of the most famous Irish monks. And I can't remember his name now. It's been too many years. But I like looking at some of those in the margin images and little notes that are there. They were a hoot.
They're hilarious. No, you can just see some bored monk drawing.
Oh yeah, no, exactly. Yeah,
that's something you mentioned books because you're a bibliophile. Do you cover that in the world building? Because you see in a lot of fantasy worlds, people write, "Oh, the books were ubiquitous. They're just books everywhere." Because you're used to that in the modern world, but people don't factor in what books were like before the Gutenberg printing press existed. So is that something that's covered in the world building and the living fantasy sides of these novels?
I believe it's covered in living fantasy somewhat. But yeah, no, you're right. It was an art form, and they couldn't rush through these things, and it was people doing it hand in hand. Was that crazy? I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Thomas Jefferson invented some kind of machine that where he wrote his letters, it would write the other, it would make a copy of it while he was writing it.
Yeah, I've seen that. That is insane. They thought of it back then. Basically, he made himself an invisible servant, and we all need one of those.
Yeah.
So is the economy of your world something that's covered as well, like in these books?
Yes. Yeah. The economy is covered in living fantasy and world building.
Okay.
You mean Gary tackles the question of gold pieces and all everything goes
But I'm just thinking, like, Sparky and I were in a lot of games with James Ward that we were told were done the old school way. And what I learned is we would hire people and they would always die. And so you make you wonder, do you have
like killing horses too?
Yeah.
Life
insurance packages for your employees because, you know, you've got the reputation as the guy who kills off your henchmen.
Yes. Gary was pretty, if probably a few friendly arguments we had about that. He wanted to ditch the gold standard, the gold piece standard, and replace it with a dollar standard and create an economy of scale for all of this stuff.
His own Bretton Woods agreement.
No, we can't do that. That's crazy.
But it does make you wonder what the creature at Jekyll Island really was now that we've got fantasy, because the creature might actually be something, some crazy succubus or whatever. If you know, you know, people. Yeah. So what was the consensus? So did you end up in this book, create your own dollar? Is it backed by gold and silver?
He created a dollar system. It's in there. I can't remember which one, but I think it's in Living Fantasy, but I can't remember now. It might be in Nation Building.
It's in Living Fantasy, I believe. Yeah.
It's in Living Fantasy. Yeah. So he created it, but we didn't go through and change everything too.
But I think World Builder also lists things in a dollar value, doesn't it?
It might. I remember it was quite a long discussion that he had over that. It went on for quite a while.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall for that one.
Yeah, it was funny. It was all in good. I mean, because Gary was great to work with because he was the creator and the writer, and we were the publishers. And we
actually, so it was brings me to a question. What was the creative process with Gary like?
Well, it depends on the project. So we didn't do writing for him. He wrote or he had ideas and he hired editors. And so he created eventually when we first started working with him, he was just kind of sending us manuscripts that he had finished and we began working on things. But then as steam began picking up and I think he began developing his own company, Trigy, kind of building, fleshing it out, he started hiring writers to write for him. So he would basically pitch ideas to us. And this is what I want to do. And I don't think we ever said no. That's crazy.
Do you want to be the man that said no to Gary Gygax?
Yeah, I mean, and they were great ideas. So why not? And the funniest, saddest conversation that I had with Gary was just before he crossed over. We were up there at the Winterdark, and he sat down, and we went over the Kings of England, Kings of France game. And he had sent the game to us. Peter Bradley and I had kind of put it all together and done the art and laid the cards out, mostly Peter Bradley. And then I presented it to Gary, and we were sitting at the table, and I remember we went through each card by card. He read them all, made corrections or notes or whatever. And then at the end of it, he said, well, this is what I would like to do. This is what I'd like us to work on in the future. And we proceeded to have like an hour. I can't remember, Davis, if you were there at the conversation or not.
No.
And we had a conversation like an hour and a half somewhere in all of this troll mess. I've got the notes that I wrote down, but I remember seeing Davis shortly thereafter and saying, good sweet Lord, we're not going to have enough time to do any of our own projects because he's working more than he's ever worked in his life. And he wants to do all of these projects. And of course that all comes to an end, but he was insanely energetic. He was fun to work with. He was easy. He would send an email over. This is what I'd like to work on. This is what I conceptualize. I would digest it or whatever, run it by Davis. Mac had left the company at that point. And then, you know, yeah, Gary, however. And he turned the manuscripts over. We would do the art and the layout and the editing and trade dress and all of that was on us. But he and his team did the writing.
So you've got the Kickstarters for the world building how-to manuals. Are you guys ever going to come out with some of the Gygax? I think there was a castle you mentioned he designed that was going to get published. What's going on with that?
So the court order that we have now, that includes all of the material with the Gygaxian fantasy worlds and all of the material with Castle Zagig and a few other properties. Davis's favorite Hall of Many Pains, the Hermit, which we've just done, and the Kings of England, Kings of France board game. But so the Castle Zagig material is absolutely monstrous. It involves the town of Yggdrasil, which is finished, the Eastmark, which is the region around Yggdrasil, which is finished, and the bluff where Castle Zagig sits, which overlooks Eastmark and Yggdrasil, and portions of that are finished. There's the Castle Zagig itself, which has three areas, the precincts, the foundation, and the towers. Those are done, written by Gary Gygax and Jeffrey Talanian. And then the Mouths of Madness, which are the caves on that bluff. Those are done, written by Jeffrey Talanian of Northwind Adventures and Gary Gygax. And then beneath that are 17 levels of the dungeon. Those are not written. The first level is, the other 16 are not, but we will be doing all of those levels. We've got Gary's notes, Gary's maps. We've employed Mike Stewart, who is well known in the old school AD&D community. He's worked for us for years. He's worked on his own for years. He knew Gary. He worked with Gary on Yggdrasil. So he's very well in tune with what Gary wanted, or at least Gary's style, I should say. And we have Gary's notes. So we'll be doing the 17 levels, but we won't be doing anything beyond that. Gary had, unless we find notes on it, Gary had open, much like the GFW series, he had open-ended Castle Zagig, the dungeons. I remember once I made a press release where I talked about, we're going to release the 17 levels of Castle Zagig. And he shot me an email I've got it somewhere. He said, oh, so now you're the arbiter of how big Castle Zagig is and how big the dungeons are. It was really funny because clearly he had more now he had more levels that he wanted to do. But unless we can find Gary's notes on said levels, we're not going to do them. We'll stick strictly with Gary's stuff.
And Castle Zagig, for those who don't know, it's Gary's culminating work. It's the place. It is the most famous castle. We can't use the name, the original name. That's locked down in copyright.
We can't use Greyhawk. Oh, that.
We can't use the name Castle Greyhawk.
Because, oh, you said it again. No.
Wizards of the Coast owns it, so we can't use that name. But it's the culminating work. It is the place where all those, not all, but, you know, thousands, years and years, decades of adventures occur. You know, and it's one of his, it's his most famous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Place. And it's never been published as Gary wanted to publish.
There's been a few, but never has Gary envisioned
it. Yeah. No. So this is it. For anyone who wants the Gary Gygax thing, this would be it, Castle Zagig.
And is that coming out soon, or do you have plans for that one?
So we've got the Kickstarter on the GFW series first quarter. The second quarter, we're going to be redoing the Player's Handbook, Castles and Crusades Player's Handbook, CKG, the Castle Weaver's Guide to Monsters and Treasures, having removed all of the open gaming licenses from it and the SRD material. Now we're deep in that. So second quarter will be a Kickstarter on those three books, and third quarter we're planning on the first section of Castle Zagig, which will be the castles, the Mouths of Madness, and maybe the first level of the dungeons themselves.
And is this the Castle Zagig? Is that in a generic world? Is it in the worlds that you have for Castles and Crusades, whose name I can't pronounce? But you and I have talked about that before. The worlds you created.
Yes,
if you're right, you can pronounce it however you want.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. It's fine.
So it's set above the Eastmark Folio, or the Eastmark. And Yggdrasil, and Yggdrasil is a town. Man, is it 8,000 people, Dave? Is it 8,000 or 9,000 people? Is the size of that town, and it's a port town on a river. And the Eastmark is, I don't know, 25 square miles. It's not very big. And there's Castle Zagig. So you can take it and put it in any setting that you are playing. Homebrew, Our World of Eric Davis's in Zaya, a Greyhawk from the old world, or Eberron from, I guess that's fifth edition's world. You know, Forgotten Realms. I don't know any more worlds beyond that. But you can put it in any setting that you want to, because it's small and contained.
But highly detailed.
Highly detailed, yes. Very
highly detailed.
So when you release the these books, we've talked about the game books. Is there any, because I know Gary was pretty famous for the maps. Him and James were pretty big into that. Is there any plans on how to do the mapping stuff, a book on that for people that want to learn how to make the cartography work?
So we'll do it. We'll publish this in two ways. The maps will come out. They will come with each book, will come with a series of maps that are kept in a folder in the back of the book. It's kind of glued to the back of the book so that you can access the maps that go with that portion of the setting itself. Chuck Cumbo, who works for TLG, he is very, very insistent on creating player-friendly maps so that we can use them on VTT, and you can, you know, cut off the DM's notes and room numbers and all of that stuff. So they'll be available in that. As for a how-to, we hadn't really planned on doing any kind of how-to with the maps, how to create your own or what have you, because they will come with a mountain of maps that the setting calls for.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, you mentioned a castle, and there's a lot more than people think when you design a castle, because can it be supported by the ground around it?
Yes.
Building a castle in the marshes isn't going to work so well.
Yes.
You mean the moat house isn't prime real estate? It'll be there fine, right? No.
Is that something that might have been, covered when you're doing the world building into, I guess, the Living Fantasy, then? Is that the kind of stuff that's in there?
So there was now that you say castles, I think there was a castle, it was a fortress building. There was a book called Fortress Building that's in that series that didn't arrive at our desk. And I don't know if it was ever written or partially written or what have you. So that certainly would have been in that. But I can tell you now, when he built Castle Zagig, when he wrote Castle Zagig, it definitely covers the sediment and the rock and all that stuff that the dungeons and the castle itself are cut through. But we don't have a how-to from the GFW series. That wasn't part of the 7, nor is it part of the 3 that we were
probably. Well, you've mentioned you've published some of your own how-tos through Trollord Games. Is that something you guys have covered already?
So we have not, but I will tell you that Peter Bradley and I have been working very quietly behind the scenes on a Castles book. Basically, nice. What I've asked him to do is take actual historical real-world castles like Harlech Castle, and I believe it's in Wales, and I want a very, very detailed map of the castle, scaled to playability, but also one of those cutaway drawings that shows how people lived in it. And then, and Davis doesn't know this yet, but Davis and I will be writing the histories of the castle and how to make it playable in your game.
That's one of the things I learned accidentally.
Davis will find out about that later this year.
Davis looks very happy about this revelation.
That's one of the things I learned incidentally when we hired I hired a cover designer who did the map for one of the books I wrote. And I had, when I gave him my sketch map, I had inadvertently drawn a castle that actually exists in Wales. And I asked the illustrator that, because he'd been there, and he's, well, castles, its form follows function, right? So there's going to be a lot of sameness. If you describe the right terrain, anyone that built a castle there is going to build it the same way for the same reasons.
Right.
And so, but knowing what those factors are when you're designing, it's going to affect how you lay that out. And I think some of the games I've seen, I'm like, yeah, you just gave yourself a giant blind spot to attack that place because you didn't factor all that stuff in.
Yeah, no, that's true. That the form follows function, and the castles, whether you're talking about hill forts or castles in, say, like Western France versus castles that you would find in, say, the Levant, built in the same time period. Although there are some similarities in like the nature of that construction, like, you know, the crenellations and stuff like that, and some defensive bulwarks. Different types of stones and different types of foundations and different types of armies or opponents require different types of castles. And you will find that that is supported by localized, you know, castle structures, which are all very similar, like in this time period and range, you know, and geography. But as soon as like the nature of the armies change, or, you know, the nature of warfare changes, the castles change appropriately. And they're built in different places or in different manners. So, for example, when cannons get introduced, this is when you get the star-shaped fortresses getting built. Yes. And what they move to is those really, really thick earthenwork walls. You know, it's stone-faced, but it's earth throughout the whole thing until you have the other stone face on the interior. But you get these star face, so you get these, you know, what is it called, inflate shots and stuff like that. But where you found that same construction, interestingly enough, was in France during Gaul at the time, when Caesar was attacking, the time period just before that. They also had big earthenwork walls because they were easier to construct and more, and I'd say equally durable considering your opponents, as stone walls would be. Okay. So the people of Gaul would have these, or prior to really pretty much Caesar's invasion, like these wooden, big, huge wooden log exteriors just filled with earth because you could build them quicker. You know, wood was readily available, whereas stone, you know, had to be worked and cut and stuff like that.
And this is why we'll have Davis write this book.
Those things.
That's one of those things that most people don't realize is when, I know, the History Channel for a while, when they actually pretended to talk about history, they had a series where they would...
You mean the UFO channel?
Hey, what's wrong with aliens?
Two warriors that never met in real life and what that would look like. And one of the things that they harp on for the average person that I learned as a military historian is, and yeah, I know we're running on time, but is the weapons, the defense and offensive weapons and protective equipment, all, it's a yin and a yang. As you develop A, I counter with B, and it goes back and forth. And so what you have in your world is going to be sort of proportional to what the enemy is going to have. And that's part of the world building too.
Yes. Yeah. I think incorporating that arms race that goes back almost, I would probably say 100 to 250,000 years.
I think we're just best friends. I'm liking you more and more the more you talk. You know,
Dave is a smart guy. He should write a arms and armor book.
That's what he should do.
I mean, he's got spare time. He doesn't have anything important to do.
Wait, wait. What am I on right now? The cost of weapons and how to generate them.
You're almost done.
Yes. No, yeah, no, no. Yeah, yeah. I've sent over, I will say, I have sent over all the big files are in editing now. Or
they're queued up.
They're queued up for editing. All the big files. Now it's just finishing up like the smaller files. Yada, yada, yada.
Yes, for those who don't know that, Davis is finishing up a book called Adventurer's Armory for Castles and Crusades.
So as we bring this home, I know you guys are tight on time. When you write these books and when Gary wrote the ones that you're publishing that were his, what would you say the age level of the readability is? Because obviously some gamers go as young as 5 and 6, right? But not all books can be written for a 5-year-old. So what would you say as far as the tomes that you're producing, these books, what would the age range be where it's probably okay for them to understand it?
10, 11, 12 and above, I would think. Some of it younger, like the World Builder is half of it is just lists. So anyone could pick it up and kind of go through it. But probably for, to kind of get what's going on in them, I'd say around 10, 11.
Yeah, I think digesting it. Now, this is what I'm going to suggest, especially for those of you with children, is even if they're 8 years old and can barely read a word, throw it in front of them. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I got to say, and Davis has got kids. I got kids. Kids are actually a lot smarter than people think they are. So they can take it a lot.
And some of it's written in what's called Gygaxian prose. So, and Gary used some archaic words, sentence constructions that stretch back like into the 19th century and stuff. But anyway, it's really nice to read Gygaxian prose. And your chance to learn new words goes up astronomically as soon as you start reading it. And it can, veer off into crazy amounts of area as you look up the word.
That's true of Gygax, but Davis, not to stroke your ego or anything, I can tell the materials you've written and some of the word choices you make. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna have to have a dictionary here. I gotta look this up.
Yeah,
you've expanded my knowledge too.
That's one of the things that you learn when you're trying to go from having been academically trained in writing to write fiction is sentence structure is different because academics, the more commas, the better. Like you want to put 12 conjunctive clauses, rock on. Your editor on the fiction side, not so much.
And I use commas like candy,
I had to learn not to. So I feel your pain, sir. Is there anything about this Kickstarter that we didn't cover that you think we need to before we let you guys go?
Yes, the early bird special, Kent. Go over the early birds.
That's true. I completely forgot about that. So I don't know when this is going to air, but we do have for early bird, there'll be early bird special with it where you're going to get entered into a raffle for some very interesting stuff that we'll announce later this week or early next week. The Kickstarter will be structured such that you don't have to buy all 7 books. You can get one or more, one or two or three or four. Or all 7, however you want to do it.
Yes.
What is the timeline for the early bird special? I can adjust when we air this to make that a viable option.
So the early bird special is probably going to be the first 24 hours, maybe 48 hours of backers. We launch on the 11th. And anyone who pledges, and of course they're going to have to stay a backer all the way through the Kickstarter, their name will be entered into a raffle to win. And plus you'll get a free PDF of all the books, but your name will be of the original books. Your name will be entered in this raffle to win some interesting material from the Troll Lord Dungeon.
We're pulling 3 items from the dungeon that will be highly appreciated by
that's women. Ominous, gentlemen.
Yeah. I mean, I've missed my friend. He was a gnome. He went missing in one of your adventures. Could I have him back?
JR's gnome is returned.
All right. So I will air this before this launch.
Blended him up. I'm drinking your gnome.
Interesting. Actually, no, I gotta let you go. That could lead a whole nother I will air this before you launch then, so that way everybody that's listening, if you listen to it in time, you can back it in time and maybe enter that to win. We will go from there. So Davis, mystery prize. How can listeners and viewers at home find you on the wild, wild interwebs?
Twitter.
Okay.
I am pretty active on Twitter and
let's say the Troll Lord Games Twitter page. That's mostly Davis. A little bit of Grace Slide Day.
Yeah, that's
the difference.
That's my
That's where I expunge ideas is on Twitter, or I find something interesting on Twitter. And that's where I contact people as well. If I find something interesting, I typically repost. I repost y'all's stuff a lot.
You shared some of our episodes, yeah.
Yes. And then I find particular things interesting, and I'll contact people as well. Actually, I really like talking to the fans. So that's one of the worst things about me going to a con is I don't really do anything other than just talk to people.
We did a kick out of this then, Davis. When we did the interview with Steve Chanel, why am I saying your last name when you're right there? When we interviewed Steve about his when you guys were introducing the world that for the Castles and Crusades, yeah, and it hadn't gotten shared by your people, and I reached out because Chuck had been the point of contact. He goes, no, social media, that's Davis's fault, not mine. All right, and, Steve, how can listeners and viewers find you at home if they want to? Sometimes he's on the Discord.
Discord would probably be the best. Yeah, Discord's the best. I get on Facebook a little bit, but I forget about Facebook. I got a Twitter account. I forget about it too. I do run an AMA. This is probably the best way. Spark and I talk all the time on my AMA on Tuesdays on Twitch, 4:30. I rarely miss that show. So 4:30 Central Standard Time. I just open it up and I'll chat with anyone who comes in about just mostly movies and books and comic books.
Aliens.
And Dr. Pepper. Alien cheeseburger and Dr. Pepper fan. So there's a lot of that.
Now I want to know if you can cook an alien into a cheeseburger to drink with you.
There you go.
Damn it. Gnome.
All right. So, and
that's a million-dollar idea.
Is it?
Is it really? No, you start a burger joint called Alien Burgers, you know?
And there you go. That is a good idea.
That's a million-dollar idea.
Oh, it probably already exists in Area 51 and all those, like whatever. But okay,
yes, so in a food truck now.
Barkey's got free time; he doesn't have anything else to do. So we will link to that, and we will link to all of the Trollord game stuff, which is who knows how many of their minions manning, but their Discord community is very active. If you're looking as a new dungeon master, as a new player. I have never asked a question there that I haven't within like 15 seconds been bombarded with 100 different answers. Sometimes the answers are more than you ever wanted. Like, dude, I just wanted to know what dice to use, not like how they're made and where they're like. It's a great community, and they've fostered that, and they keep it pretty apolitical, just family friendly shenanigans and what's not to love. And dead gnomes, apparently, because. Is that something that started with Trollord Games, or was that something that...
That's Davis.
So, okay. All right. And then with that, I appreciate you guys coming on. You can find us on our Linktree, linktr.ee, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the BitChutes, the Rumbles, the YouTube, our Twitter, our email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com for professional purposes only, people. Keep the shenanigans over to Madam Stabby's Instagram, Twitter, or email. You can send her all the hate mail. She loves it. She'll make you cry in response, but that's on you, people. That's between you and your priest. And with that being said, we also link to our Facebook group and Facebook page. You can also follow us on our website at anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on, or you can support the show more directly over at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Be sure to put it in the comment section that is for the podcast, and I will promise I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink until the coffee brand coffee pours out of their eyeballs, people. It's glorious. We should film it, charge admissions. You'll love it. And that is, use the code PODCASTGRUNTS with the link below and you get 10% off. Ooh, coffee and fantasy worlds. That ought to be its own book. Anyway, I digress. Thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my crazy co-host, I am JR, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. Thank you two for coming on. This was way too much fun. It's hard to believe I can call this work, but I'm here for it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming on, Sparky. I'm going to rope you into some more episodes, Sparky. You don't need to sleep.
Oh, and Dune is coming on in 3 days. Dune 2.
That's right. Well, it's already on when we air this. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Wait, it's out?
No, Davis, they're going to air this show later.
Oh,